This is the Urban Political,
the podcast on urban theory, research, and activism.
Hello, listeners. Across the world, a rightward populist turn is reshaping politics, everyday life, and the spaces we inhabit. This series examines the rise of authoritarian urbanism, born from the convergence of state power, militarized violence, infrastructure-led development, and racialized and religious nationalism. As neoliberalism faces a crisis of legitimacy, these forces work to consolidate control and drive new waves of urbanization that deepen social polarization. Alongside these authoritarian transformations, we trace the everyday democratic practices, subtle acts, collective refusals, and imaginative alternatives that contest authoritarian rule and open space for different urban futures. Through conversations with researchers, activists, and practitioners, the series takes stock of this authoritarian conjuncture and asks how power, urbanization, and resistance intersect in shaping our worlds. And now, enjoy the episode, the first episode of our series.
Welcome. I am Gareth Fern. I work at the University of Manchester, and we've put these episodes together basically on the back of editing a special issue for Urban Studies on sort of authoritarian term within urban politics. I edited this with Gulden Ozatagan and Ida Aridin, and that'll be available online and linked in the show notes. But what we wanted to do with these podcasts, these three podcasts, is to invite both people who contribute to the issue and others who've written about this issue and topic and sort of relatedly, to kind of expand and kind of discuss the things that we focused on within the issue, within a sort of authoritarian politics of urban space across different geographies, to try and sort of draw out some sort of commonalities and differences and to see, you know, where we think this is heading. In the issue, we try to understand in more detail this kind of authoritarian turn, sort of which we see as something developing particularly distinctly in the last sort of 10 to 20 years. Something we can see playing out in very different contexts, in different ways. And I think at this point, it's not really controversial to say, just in general, that there's a kind of more global tendency towards authoritarian government. But even though we're sort of kind of focusing on how we've seen this in the last 10, 20 years, we're not obviously arguing this is like some completely new invention. If we think of just sort of neoliberalism as a kind of period, the Pinochet's Chile, Margaret Thatcher in the UK, the Southern Strategy in the United States, the structural adjustment programs across much of the sort of global South, like these were obviously like kind of violent interventions in many ways, you know, down the barrel of a gun in terms of something like, you know, what happened in Chile in 1974. So the sort of very beginning kind of animus of this kind of neoliberal return in the 1970s was an attempt to kind of curtail demands for more democratic control of social and economic life, whether that was something like the US civil rights movement, whether it was trade union power in Europe, or whether it was like the different types of kind of post-colonial government that were sort of asserting their rights over natural resources or new development models at odds with kind of the US interests, right? When we're trying to think of this more recently, though, what we've done in our writing for the issue particularly is focus on the work of scholars like Ian Brough and Kerem Boek-Tansel, who've highlighted like a resurgence in more authoritarian practices interconnected with a kind of growing insecurity of neoliberal hegemony, right, at sort of national and also kind of global levels, right? Ian Brough's highlighted the work of two important writers who actually wrote on the sort of emergence of the neoliberalism in the 70s, Stuart Hall and Nikki Plantas, and I think they can kind of provide us with some useful terms and tools to kind of understand the present. Hall, I think, which is what we're going to focus on more today, I think Stuart Hall wrote about the UK, how the Margaret Thatcher's government mobilized an authoritarian populism, which targeted a series of kind of enemies within the nation, right? Trade unions, queer activists, Irish Republicans, ethnic minorities. But it crucially kind of tied together as if they're acting in some sort of conspiratorial plot against the nation, right? That's the kind of populism these enemies were working, yeah, hand in hand in some way to kind of bring down Britain. That was the sort of Thatcherite rhetoric. He was also in conversation with Nikos Blantas, the Greek Marxist writer, who focused more squarely on what he called authoritarian statism, which he argued was marked by, quote, an intensive state control over every sphere of socioeconomic life, which is combined with a radical decline of the institutions of political democracy, with a draconian and multi-form curtailment of so-called formal liberties, unquote. And this ranges from sort of increased militarization of domestic policing, which borrows from colonial experiences, to the professionalization of kind of political parties away from their historic kind of mass membership bases. As I say, what we're going to focus on today, I think, is more this kind of populism side, but also the popular contestation of neoliberal politics and policy. I think the crucial difference between sort of the site and 70s is now is that a lot of these authoritarian kind of discourses and politics are mobilized not against like a Keynesian welfare state or even a sort of post-colonial nationalist or even like socialist kind of government. They're mobilized against states and political parties who've actually implemented a range of neoliberal reforms through the 90s and 2000s, such as privatization, marketization, deregulation, etc., whether they be center left or like center right, right? So I think these discourses, populist discourses, have gained traction through this kind of wider contestation of neoliberal policy. And you know, there's been arguments for and even attempts to sort of deliver a kind of left populism as well that challenges neoliberal politics in different countries. But crucially, I think this is perhaps because neoliberalism as a hegemonic kind of block is failing to deliver for larger sections of the population. So that could be in terms of the UK, maybe we think of that in terms of austerity and like a housing crisis. In India, we might think of that in terms of like Modi's sort of leading a kind of period of jobless growth, or just kind of collapsing living standards in the US sort of so-called Rust Belt. And of course, the kind of ecological crisis that looms over kind of everything that we do, right? So I think this kind of contestation of neoliberal policy, and there's a profit from it, crucially, within this kind of authoritarian kind of politics, hasn't really led to a major repudiation of like the winners of this period, right? It's not like these many of these kind of populist figures that we see are denouncing private sector housing development or you know, promising to like take control of like you know, disruptive kind of corporate power in terms of the environment or something. Instead, it's just kind of led to a kind of revised cast of enemies being blamed for all of our sort of problems, right? Muslims, immigrants, sort of so-called woke social movements, right? And the state is targeting these groups with increased violence and even endorsing a kind of vigilantism against these so-called enemies. These three episodes are going to kind of explore different aspects of the relationship between the city, urbanism, and kind of authoritarian neoliberalism. I think what we're seeing in terms of the city in many different places is an intensification, actually, of neoliberal type development models, but it's accompanied with an expansion of state violence and the targeting of these enemies as the cause of various urban problems, right? That could be rising crime, it could be high rents. But cities are also kind of identified as places of a kind of dangerous cosmopolitanism, often in contrast to kind of real and authentic lives of people who live in rural or small towns, often, usually in that case, the ethnic majority of a particular country. Cities are also sites of protests and violent police crackdowns, as we're seeing in places like, you know, Istanbul and Los Angeles at this very moment. There are also places where the treatment of like migrants or government policy is kind of contested, right? In those, as well as kind of real estate development. And real estate developers and real estate capital increasingly kind of seems to need defending, right? In terms of its new developments and mega projects, because those very projects and developments don't seem to be addressing the social reproductive crisis or ecological challenges that we face, right? Maybe we can also see and discuss how these authoritarian actions both assert power, but also maybe reveal a more fragile hegemony, the neoliberal policies and the sort of interests and historical bloc is empowered. Okay, right, I'm going to show up now after the intro. And I've got, fortunately, three like exceptional guests who are going to help do the difficult work for me. So I'm delighted to be joined by, firstly, Natalie Koch, who is the Professor of Geography at Syracuse University's Maxwell School of Citizenship and Public Affairs in the USA.
Hi, thank you.
We also have Malini Ranganathan, who is the Associate Professor in the School of International Service at American University in Washington.
Thanks very much for having me, Gareth. I'm excited to be here.
Thank you very much. Thanks for joining us. Finally, last but not least, we have Leonardo Fontes, who is a professor in the Department of Sociology at the State University of Campinas and a researcher at the Center for Urban Ethnographies at the Brazilian Center for Analysis and Planning.
Hi, Gareth. Thank you for having me here. It's a pleasure.
Thank you. Okay, great. So, first, I'm going to go, I think, to Natalie to ask you your book, about a bit about your book and some of the arguments in it, which was Spatializing Authoritarianism. It was a really useful like resource for us when we were developing the special issue. And one of the sort of arguments you make is that in the US, authoritarianism was kind of seen as or portrayed as something maybe external, which corrupted the kind of, you know, virtuous, scare quotes, liberal democracy of the USA. Now, obviously, we have another Trump term. Could you perhaps start by explaining how authoritarianism is kind of being manifested and talked about in the USA today and how this relates to kind of the spatial and urban politics of the USA?
Yeah, thank you.
In my reading of the authoritarian trends in the United States, I think it's really important to contextualize the fact that the othering of authoritarianism is fundamentally part of the American nationalist mythology, and that nationalist mythology is one that celebrates democracy. But it also actively erases the settler colonial project that is the United States, which means that the entire country and the democratic project has been founded on what I would very clearly argue are authoritarian practices of seizing the land of Native Americans, of committing acts of genocide and theft of resources. So I think it's really important to start with that and to acknowledge that the whole American celebration of democracy is rooted in that erasure. In the last 15 years or so, we have started to see much more discussion of authoritarianism within American politics, but always still sort of referencing that as somehow foreign. The United States was the victorious great superpower at the end of the Cold War. And I think that discourse has really dominated how Americans continue to talk about authoritarianism today, because that Cold War legacy sort of pit the authoritarian Soviet Union against the quote-unquote democratic United States. So what I think that you have seen in the last years, though, where people have been discussing authoritarianism vis-a-vis the Trump regime, is that when he first put in his name for running for the presidency, I don't think that many people really understood his authoritarian proclivities. But as the first administration went forward, you could really start to see a number of very authoritarian impulses that underpinned a lot of his initiatives, including, for example, the so-called Muslim ban in his first term, etc. So in this, you could start to see that Americans in the sort of mainstream media, and to some extent also in American academia, were starting to challenge that nationalist mythology and to say, oh, well, maybe there are some people within our voting populace that like this. And so I think Americans started to tune into that and to realize that they're not sort of immune from the draw of an authoritarian or autocratic leader. In the years since then, I think one of the big problems for the left in the United States after Donald Trump was voted out and Joe Biden came into office is that a lot of liberals sort of thought, oh, okay, we're done and dusted. That's over. We can close that chapter. Of course, that was completely wrong. Those people never went away. Those proclivities and interests in the sort of authoritarian approach to politics that Trump manifests, it never really went away. And in fact, what has been happening instead, or what happened the entire time that Biden was in office, is that Trump's cult of personality, which I've written about in the chapter in that Specialized Authoritarianism book, that cult of personality never went away. And those people got to work really trying to solidify and find other ways to continue that authoritarian project. And they have been preparing for this moment of Trump coming back into office since then. And so what we have seen in the last months since he took office for the second term is the floodgates have opened, essentially, in terms of that preparatory work that the Trump regime and the cult has been doing for the last 4 years. So how liberals and others have sort of been reacting to this within the U.S. context, I would say, is with shock and horror, but they also are starting to feel the effects of an authoritarian system touching down on their bodies in a way that many of those privileged liberal elites never had before. So if you talk to Black and Brown people in the United States, they will be very direct and very clear that they didn't ever have the rewards of quote unquote democracy the way that white elites did in the United States. And so where you have a lot of this outrage in the liberal media, and I would say especially amongst academics, and this big broadening conversation now about American academics seeking refuge in other countries. That's simply because those people had never been touched by the authoritarian practices of the United States government for many years. And so now that that is coming to them and to their livelihoods, that is a big change. That sort of saturation of these authoritarian practices is just feeling more intimate for many people who long had appreciated the benefits of the sort of American democracy, but never actually had to come face to face with those authoritarian practices. So with that, I would say we can see that outrage as it sort of manifests related to universities. Many cities across the entire United States, their entire economy is built around the university. This is absolutely across the U.S. So major state universities, public universities, private universities, Syracuse University, where I am right now, Syracuse, the city, would really struggle to go forward if the university wasn't here. So we do see that in that sort of the Trump regime's attack on universities in particular, where that is going to have ripple out effects in all of these various cities that are hosting these big universities. Beyond that, I would also say that what you can see with this particular iteration of the Trump regime is that Trump always has been a fan of spectacle. And in my writing authoritarianism, I've always focused on spectacle. And I'm most interested in what I would call sort of benevolent authoritarian regimes. These are regimes that use a lot of positive things, celebrations, social benefits that they like to distribute to the people. These are sort of the benevolent variation of authoritarianism, where those spectacles, like the celebratory spectacles, are often concentrated in cities. Because if you're going to have the World Cup or you're going to have a big national celebration, that's going to be in a city. So that's a way that you can sort of send a positive image of the regime to those people. What I have found absolutely fascinating in the last couple of months of watching what's happening with the Trump regime is that they're not interested in celebratory spectacle or benevolence. This is very punitive variation of authoritarian practices that they are using. And so what we see instead, and this is a distinction that Michel Foucault makes in his book on Discipline and Punish between celebratory and punitive spectacle. And in Discipline and Punish, Foucault specifically talks about the drawing and quartering of Damiens as a sort of spectacle of regime showing its power and scaring people by this use of sheer force and brutality. That is a way to instruct the population in where the red lines are and aren't. So I think that is exactly what you can see with the Trump attack on Los Angeles and the use of the National Guard in Los Angeles to round up innocent people who, have immigration backgrounds. So that is effective because it has this chilling effect. And I can tell you absolutely, it has had a chilling effect already in the United States, where people are very scared of protesting. They've been using surveillance technologies, monitoring who is attending these protests. So that use of punitive spectacle has really been quite dramatic with Trump 2.0. And is also what I find so fascinating about the people who are in the regime right now, is that they also seem to be quite naive about how authoritarianism works, because this is kind of a silly point to emphasize as a scholar of authoritarianism. We talk in that literature about authoritarian regime resilience, how it's actually the benevolent autocrats that have a longer life, essentially. So the punitive regimes are not very successful because taking away social benefits and using pure brute force and brutality, that is not a very effective way to maintain the regime's long duration. Where I sort of see this Trump 2.0 regime going is that they're using these punitive tactics. They're taking away all of these social benefits from precisely those people that Gareth, you mentioned in your introduction, who have been disenfranchised. by many of these neoliberal projects, they are taking away exactly those benefits from those people. And this is, I think it may take a while, but I think it's really going to undercut that base of support. It may not necessarily get rid of the autocrats in power, but it is nonetheless a way that you might actually see them precipitating their own decline faster than if they had taken a different strategy of doing more investment in social welfare provisions, et cetera. But that's absolutely not what we see happening with this regime.
Yeah. Interesting. Very interesting. I guess we could have had a whole like special issue or set a podcast just on the relationship between universities and authoritarian governments in, you know, across the world. And yeah. And I think also the point about like the kind of randomness almost of some of the targeting that's happening in America, right, creates this kind of chilling effect. Cause it's almost like not systematic. It's just like, okay, well, just anybody now is kind of, well, anybody within a certain kind of broad range of people could be like targeted, you know?
And people are also increasingly aware that their social media and other public expressions of free speech, that those are also being very, very much curtailed at the moment. So that has led a lot of people that I know in academia in particular to recalibrate certain things about their research or to not speak out at certain events or just to cancel participation in certain things, to not travel abroad. There's a lot of ways that people are already finding that they're changing their speech patterns.
Okay, I'll move on to ask Melanie, because your work obviously covers the USA, but also in India as well. So I wanted to kind of, maybe we can move on to sort of connecting those two places a little bit. So obviously Modi, you know, was elected in 2014, a few years before Trump. And, you know, I think it's also fair to say that his election marked a shift towards a more divisive and authoritarian politics, so obviously built on a kind of Hindu nationalism and the so-called Gujarat model of sort of development, which he sort of pushed when he was the minister of Gujarat state. So I guess a connection already where you can see with Trump and obviously his reliance on something like Christian nationalism as a sort of basis of some of his power. But I think one of the ways your work actually connects some of these two regimes is through the role of corruption, and I'm putting corruption in sort of quotes, and its kind of relation to capitalism and racial capitalism, and particularly with regards to like urban land and urban development and urban space. So I guess it would be helpful or useful to discuss a bit how discourses and practices of corruption, I think maybe that's the right words, relate to authoritarianism.
I'd like to answer this question along three lines, Gareth. One is, you know, the relationship between corruption and the city. Put that in a sort of critical light. It's corruption not as a given, but also corruption discourse and the city. The second is corruption and right-wing authoritarianism. And then the third is really the intersection of all three. That is to say, corruption, the city, and right-wing authoritarianism, and what is the relation between these. And here I'm really going to come to your question about Trump and Modi, but also the very, very material connection between the Trump business empire and right-wing politics in India around real estate, right? Unbeknownst to a lot of people in the West, in fact, Trump has more real estate deals in India than anywhere else in the world, right? And you have a multi-billion dollar high-rise luxuries in the finance capital of Mumbai, you know, right next to the sprawling working class slums of Mumbai, right? So you have this sort of visceral and visual telegraphing of the grotesque inequality that exists in the world, like, you know, through these intersections that I'll be discussing. So my co-authored book titled Corruption Plots, Stories, Ethics, and Publics of the Late Capitalist City opens with the observation that corruption talk, that is to say, a buzz, a kind of affect around the abuse of publicly held power, right? This sort of affect and talk was really erupting everywhere in the first two decades of the 21st century, right? The contemporary era of late capitalism has seen an unprecedented concentration of wealth and power for a narrow global elite class, especially those associated with finance, landed and real estate capital, fossil capital, and of course now increasingly AI-related tech oligarchical capital. Concomitant with the increasing economic precarity and dispossession of the world's majority. Accusations of corruption express this kind of disillusionment with the sort of promises of government and global market, not as a kind of aberration, of some sort of perfect ideal, but almost corruption actually lays bare the normal workings of capitalist political economy, right? And its highly racialized and violent, illiberal forms. And so in the book, we sort of really take this as a point of departure. And we also then move to the fact that rapidly changing spaces of the city, which is rife with money laundering, you know, high rise shell company towers, such as that which you see in New York City and London, slum evictions, right? And of course, the notorious land grab, right? The city then becomes this very rich, very textured setting for the corruption plot. And of course, this is a double entendre on plot as land and plot as a kind of storytelling practice about the kind of normal workings of capitalism, right, in space and through these very accumulationist logics. Glittering towers give rise to rumors, a sense of scandal and media sensationalism around the abuse of power. In the language of urban theory, older forms of informality have given way to what Ananya Roy has called elite informality, a mode of urbanization through which a nexus of state and corporate power seizes land and resources with impunity. So the city becomes this stage for thinking through the abuse of power. But at the same time, we're very wary of the fact that even though corruption can call out the abuse of power, it can also be redirected for fairly regressive ends, right? So in this context of India, you have often the discourse of corruption, you know, the lumpen elected representative, you know, they're corrupt, or the lower caste or Dalit or Muslim political representative or sort of political operating in low-income settlements, they're corrupt. And this kind of absolving of the elite of corruption as well, right? So you have a kind of competing discourses of corruption within the space of the city. So then I want to come to then what is the relationship between corruption and right-wing authoritarianism? And I think that context of the sort of slipperiness of corruption talk is very helpful because, you know, you have a leader, let's say, in Brazil, like Bolsonaro, or you have a leader in the United States, like Trump, or you have a leader like Modi in India, right, proposing to clean up the country, right, and clean up the politics from corruption or vested interests when they themselves have very dubious political and economic dealings, right? So it becomes this sort of deflection game, especially potent as a tool of right-wing authoritarianism to suppress political opposition, right? In fact, right before the Lok Sabha, which is the national election, suddenly we have corruption scandals erupting, which then throws the opposition into jail, right? It's actually a very classic tool of strongman politics to leverage the corruption discourse in order to then blame your opponents or blame the minorities or blame the resistance, right? It's a very key relationship, and I think a historical one between corruption and right-wing authoritarianism, right? That cuts in many ways, but most importantly becomes, I think, a part of the arsenal of right-wing consolidation in a very almost contradictory or paradoxical way, because these right-wing leaders themselves then become immune to corruption charges, which of course is so laughable in the case of President Trump, who has a gazillion conflicts of interest, right, and going on. His own government machinery, or rather the dismantling of the government machinery, partly DOGE was a whole endeavor to dismantle the government, which it sees as having too much corruption, even while the oligarchs and the tech bros and the real estate companies are getting fattened off the very same sort of, you know, system of exchanges and favors. And the fact that this is a very paradoxical discourse also comes to light when you look at the connection between right-wing authoritarianism and corruption talk. So finally, you know, coming to all three, right? So how does corruption, the urban, and right-wing authoritarianism, you know, come together in this very, very toxic cocktail? Here, I'd like to just ask listeners to maybe Google the cover of my book, Corruption Plots, because lo and behold, on the cover of my co-authored book is the Trump Towers in Mumbai. What Trump does is he gets billions of dollars in sort of licensing fees when, let's say, someone in the global south, in this particular case, Mangal Prabhat Lodha, uses the Trump brand name to build luxury towers. So these are called the Trump Lodha Towers. there in wealthy part of Mumbai, also has, you know, a very dense working class settlements. Now, if you look at the workings of Trump Towers in India, they are highly, highly corrupt. First of all, right, there was a great expose done by an investigative journalist called Political Corruption and the Art of the Deal, which is actually a riff on Trump's book from the 80s. But it's about like the Trump organization's real estate dealings in India. And Lodha, the person who the Trump organization linked up with, is notoriously corrupt. He's being investigated for money laundering. He's being investigated for bribery. You know, he basically just picks up the phone and he can get Indian Administrative Services officers sort of transferred from one post to the other if they don't do his bidding, right? And of course, you know, the prehistory of the Trump Towers is suddenly, a slum went up in flames, right, and was burnt to the ground. And this is also a very classic Bollywood film-esque ploy to try to clear away the working poor in order to put up, you know, luxury real estate, right? So it's completely mired in sort of one ethical wrongdoing of after the other that are then sort of whitewashed because it has the Trump brand name on it, right? You have this intersection of you know, a right-wing politician in the United States doing business with Lodha. And so Lodha is not only a corrupt businessman, he's actually a minister in the Bharatiya Janata Party, which is the right-wing party, the ruling party in India. So, you know, right-wing bros lead, you know, connecting up and having a bonanza, right? And so that and really using the space of the city to advance their right-wing agendas. Now, in very different contexts, for Lodha, it has been known to spout Islamophobic rhetoric. He pushed this myth of the love jihad, where apparently, you know, Hindu women were being like whisked away and converted to Islam. And it's this, you know, it's to sort of criminalize the Muslim and, you know, demonize them. So he's responsible, along with other right-wing politicians, for touting this narrative. You know, of course, in the US, you have the very white nationalist, nativist rhetoric of Trump as well. And, you know, and then there's startling commonalities in the ways in which this sort of traditionalism and nativism merges with oligarchy and sort of the billionaire class to advance real estate interests in cities. Right? That's what I think I really want to drive home with this, the sort of third point on the intersections between the three of them. And really, you know, we're looking at a very, very unequal urban context in the U.S., increasingly in India, in the top 10% of India holds 77% of total national wealth, and that inequality is really concentrated and being advanced through those modalities of, you know, sort of real estate corruption as business as usual kind of thing.
Excellent. Okay, yeah, that's really, really interesting. Really nicely like threaded together those different kind of elements. I am interestingly enough, and on a much smaller scale, but. There's actually been a series of fires in Manchester, where I am at the moment, suspiciously around, not actually occupied buildings, fortunately, but unoccupied buildings that are probably, they're quite old and a bit expensive to, like, if you wanted to sort of redevelop them and keep them in their kind of original form. So there's been a series that have mysteriously burnt down and then are now subject to applications for, you know, like much more sort of new kind of, yeah, luxury real estate kind of development, basically. Yeah, I think, you know, it's not a coincidence that Trump's a real estate guy, basically. Like, it's not a totally incidental thing that someone who kind of grew up in that environment has that attitude towards other people and what they might think about space. And of course, like, creating these like physical spaces, these buildings, these towers that are, you know, incredibly exclusive and obviously just consolidate wealth through, you know, what are, I think, in many cases seem to be quite corrupt practices. And the fact that that's, like, you know, in his government is, you know, not a surprise at all in terms of the way his government is operating in terms of capital and various favored businesses and individuals as well. Yeah, so to move on, the next point with Leonardo, and I guess you did end that as well, Melanie, I did mention this, Melanie, that obviously, yeah, this kind of corruption and anti-corruption discourse, we see it in the US, we see it in India, we also see it in Brazil, this kind of feeling that the existing party, you know, I guess broadly in each case, the centre-left party, centrist, centre-left party or liberal party is mired in corruption, and the only, you know, it needs a strongman leader to come in and sort of change this. And obviously, Leonardo, you talk about this in terms of Brazil and particularly your work focusing on Sao Paulo. And what in your paper that you did for the special issue, I think you do a really rich kind of analysis of sort of conservative right and sort of, I guess, progressive left, if we want to call it that, coalitions or discourses that develop within the city in different parts of the city and how they sort of change over time, you know, in response to some of these kind of figures, leaders, both, I guess, Lula on one side in Brazil and Bolsonaro on the other. Yeah, and I think, you know, I think that's something that we can see sort of changing in all the countries that we've talked about, right, and also the UK too, this kind of shift in the kind of way in which these right-wing movements are able to mobilize different sections of society, or yeah, perhaps those who weren't as involved in politics before or have been able to sort of re-energize parts of their base in a way that perhaps sort of progressive forces haven't. And what you really do, I think, well, is identify some of the moral and cultural dynamics of how this happens within Sao Paulo, which is one of the key sort of electoral battlegrounds in any kind of Brazilian kind of election, at least. So yeah, I guess, could you maybe explain about how this conservative formation developed and changed, I think, in this context, and how it sort of tended towards a more intense authoritarian politics?
Yes, yes, of course, Gareth, thank you for your question. And I think that all these international networks that we see operating through the far right all over the world are very important to understand the specificities of each country. And, just to bring an example, Eduardo Bolsonaro, who is the son of Jair Bolsonaro, Brazilian former president, is right now in the United States trying to articulate some forms of sanctions against the ministers of Brazilian Supreme Court, which are judging Bolsonaro right now. So they participate in international events with Steve Bannon and with Modi, with Orban, and with Milei in Argentina, and Trump, and etc. But what I'm trying to do in this paper, and for me as a sociologist and speculative and ethnographer, it is very important to always remember that people have agency. So what I'm kind of asking here is, why do people support these leaders, and trying to find the social and historical roots of the support in different publics and different messages and discourses that circulate among urban peripheral workers from big cities, and and I'm especially worried with Sao Paulo, which is the biggest city in Brazil, and it's where I do my field work. So I'm trying to avoid all these ideas of manipulation, or that people are voting against their interest, and trying to understand why do they give their vote, or they give their support for these authoritarian leaders. And in the case of Brazil, we can identify three publics where this authoritarian and this new, especially the neoliberal authoritarian discourse circulates. The first one is what I'm calling the military authoritarianism. We must remember that Brazil was a military dictatorship from 1964 to 1985, so it was more than 20 years of a military dictatorship. And after we had the redemocratization of the country and a new constitution in 1988, there was a hope that democracy would bring new social rights, and especially when it comes to public safety, public security, there was a promise that human rights would be respected and that the situation in terms of urban violence would change. And there is an imaginary among lots of people in urban peripheries that this period of the military dictatorship, the city was safer, and that politicians were less corrupt. Of course, this is not true. And of course, what we had in the past was that the press was not free. There was no independence for the judiciary system. So it's not that there was no corruption, but people wasn't politicians were unable to hide their corruption from the public. But anyway, what we see is that this imaginary is brought back figures like Jair Bolsonaro, who is a former captain from the army and has a very strong connection with the military police. So this is another important thing. In Brazil, we have a military police, which is the most responsible police that's responsible for security in the cities. This discourse just simply says that, well, the police must be free, well, of course, between codes, to face criminal organizations. So there is always an attempt to blame human rights activists for stopping the police to act. Of course, they repeat this through social media and etc. And so this is the first important public that has this historical roots in urban peripheries. The second public that I could identify is what I'm calling a religious and a family conservatism. Brazil was colonized by Portuguese and in a partnership with the Catholic Church. So until the beginning of the 20th century, Catholicism was the official religion. And of course, we know all the importance that Catholicism brings to the family and to some conservative values. And in the late 20 or 30 years, there was an important shift towards a even more conservative discourse in religious terms that comes from evangelical Christian churches. Now, nowadays, around 25 to 30% of Brazilian population are evangelical Christians, and they emphasize even further this idea of the family is the central of the society, and that we must reinforce family values and conservative values in order to find a better way for the entire country. So this brings an opposition against feminist struggles, against LGBTQ plus rights, and etc., and any other forms of family that could show up nowadays. And finally, a third important public, and this maybe is the novelty that neoliberalism brings, is the idea of neoliberal entrepreneurialism, which I like to highlight that it is something that is embedded in the historical precarious labor market in Brazil. So we always had in Brazil over 50% of the population working in informal jobs and different forms of self-employment. But with neoliberalism came this idea that these people are not informal workers that need to be integrated in a formal job market, but they are entrepreneurs. And of course, this connects with some people's life history when they say, well, I've never depended on the state. I could never count on the state to assure me any form of social rights, any form of social protection. So now people say that I'm an entrepreneur, and that's what I feel like. I am an entrepreneur. I work for myself. I don't need any form of protection. These three publics bring together a message of, at the same time, the importance of a strong state to face criminality, to face corruption practices, a conservative way of behaving in terms of how we organize the society, how we organize our families, and a very individualistic way to enter the market through a neoliberal, entrepreneurial, neoliberal discourse. So I try to see these three publics together. They are amalgamate through what I'm calling a moral capital, which is a subtype of symbolic capital as Bourdieu defines it. So all three discourses together, they bring the importance of morality and how people should behave in their daily lives, either as a hard worker, as a family man, or someone who goes to church, who behaves properly, and who is not involved in any form of criminal activities. That connects strongly with the history and the social behavior in some urban peripheries in Brazil.
Thank you. I mean, I think that's really interesting. And I think, you know, there's a lot of things there, which I think, you know, I think we can see across other places too. And I think there's the idea of this kind of morality, obviously the role of religion, religious institutions and religious, or a particular, like, almost like radicalization of certain religious, you know, longstanding religious practices as well. And I think maybe also the thing you pointed with the moral capital, I guess, but also that last group as well, which is this kind of what I guess in Marxist terms people call like a kind of petty bourgeoisie type, petty bourgeoisie class fraction, I guess, where you have people who are both subjected to kind of the market as private individuals, but also as private kind of entrepreneurs, but then also kind of constantly butting up against the state, which they see as, yeah, in some cases corrupt, or in some cases like, you know, trying to tax them for their stuff that they've earned themselves and stuff. And I feel like, yeah, you can definitely see that kind of that figure of that person, maybe not actually that person's interests necessarily, but the figure of that person is like repeated, isn't it? Particularly in Trump's like language, is, you know, and the kind of right that's who they're standing for, even if practically they're probably standing for, you know, the CEO of an oil company or something like that, right? We've talked about this politics, I guess, of authoritarianism, and we've talked about how these right-wing groups have been political leaders and parties have been able to kind of utilize this to extend their own power you know, but sometimes for their own personal gain, but also, you know, just as a political kind of movement, I guess. I guess what I want to ask is, like, how successful do we see this as building hegemony, right? And by, I think, Natalie, when you said as well, and about in the US, how the second Trump term, they're not trying to give anyone anything, right? They're not trying to, like, build hegemony in the sense of, like, power that's built on coercion, but also consent. They seem to really have kind of rejected the consent bit and really just relying hardly on coercion. So I guess it's, I guess I'm interested in the, how you see that playing out with between the kind of state relationship to maybe state and real estate, or in terms of just how they kind of govern a city, right, and govern urban development in a sort of broad way, when there's a kind of maybe a rhetorical promise given to people of, like, the world's going to be better with me, I'll solve all your problems, I'll solve all your corruption, but in practicality it seems more and more so these leaders, or when they're in power, are relying more on a kind of coercive rather than consensual policies. So maybe Natalie, if you want to go first, and then I'll kind of come around to Melanie.
Yeah, you know, I think the immediate reaction that you see from a lot of the Trump cult followers and the actual, like, people inside, is this push to say anything bad that results from any of these policies, or basically anything bad, is so quickly pinned on the Democrats or the liberals or the, you know, the woke mind virus. It has become such an easy set of tropes in the imagination of the right wing people within the US context. And this is far right and middle of the road right, like, across the board. They've built this really robust pattern of being able to just pin that on the Democrats. Oh, well, this policy isn't working because it's Joe Biden broke it. You know, any of those things can so easily be pinned on that. So in terms of where the negative fallout of all of these attacks on social services, on things like the universities, which keep cities alive, I really do think that there's going to be that automatic response from the Trump insiders and the Trump followers, is to just say, oh, well, it's not really his fault. And this is why I think, like, having that cult of personality is so powerful. And what I wrote about several years ago already is that this is a really scary dynamic, because when the way to show your loyalty is by just repeating those blind tropes, then you see that people are not necessarily willing to participate in any active civic discourse and critique. Of course, you do also see within the U.S. context that many of the people in the Republican Party understand that their voters are upset about the hollowing out of these social services. A select few are trying to push back and challenge that. But for the most part, I sort of feel like they too are also just trying to withdraw from the public sphere. And so I think that's also just the broader trend of the limiting of public debate about certain topics, that we're not necessarily going to see very much pushback against the cancellation of SNAP benefits to the poor people in inner cities. That is generally not going to be something that is even countenanced. And of course, finally, I would just point out that this flood the zone approach is another way of limiting that public discourse about these broader concerns, whether that's in cities or in rural areas. Everybody is being flooded. Any sort of point of criticism gets lost in the shuffle once, you know, the next big crisis or next big spectacle happens later in the day.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you're right about that kind of flooding, particularly through, I mean, and this is, we actually could probably talk about this in the next episode as well, but the role of, like, social media, obviously, in this, right, is a kind of way in which it shapes politics now, is that you're able to just flood so much information into, like, people's day-to-day lives, right, in a way that just wasn't possible before. So yeah, I guess, Melanie, maybe, you know, the same sort of question to you, really, about how the extent to which this kind of authoritarian politics is supporting, yeah, is building a kind of hegemony, I guess, in cities, in terms of the relationship to state and real estate. And yeah, I guess in India, obviously, someone like Modi has probably, maybe it's falling a bit now, but over the years has kind of built it seems to have operated by building the consent of at least certain sections of society, right? Like certain intermediate caste groups or something, where he's bought off, you know, he's brought some people into the fold and excluded others.
I think the question of how consent is cultivated is really interesting. And I think it is cultivated along several axes. So, you know, as Leonardo mentioned as well, it's really this appeal to traditionalism, religion, morality, purity, right? There's a sort of sense of national purity. And this is true of all fascistic regimes, but it's a kind of hearkening back to a mythical, glorious past of a national purity, right? What most come to mind is Nazi Germany, but of course you also have the rewriting of textbooks in India, right? To erase Muslim, rulers' practices that were, you know, that were contested, you know, and of course the new narrative is to show them as villains or to raise them all together. And so along with the construction of hegemony is really the construction or the rewriting of history itself, a history that, as I mentioned, really appeals to these very traditional values. And you're absolutely right, Garrett. And so who is really the vote bank of the right-wing BJP has been shown to be upper caste, you know, Brahminical facing, that is to say, caste supremacist sort of ideology that have really kind of clung on to this notion of a kind of pure Hindu past. And incidentally, of course, and this we see with the Zionists in America and Israel, this sort of victimhood as well, right? The Hindu is being attacked by the outsider, by the Muslim, by even the Abrahamic religions, which are both the Christian and the Muslims, that fake victimhood thing is also part of this creation of a mythical past that has to then, you know, assert itself vis-a-vis the other, right? And that is the centerpiece, the linchpin of how consent is created, is to demonize the other, to then create the consolidation and the backing behind the majoritarian politics. So that's definitely part of it. The other thing that then throws a wrench into purely calling this sort of neoliberalism, and this is where it gets very interesting from an economic standpoint, is as opposed to Trump's gutting of SNAP and welfare and healthcare and et cetera, right? In India, over the last 11 years since the election of Modi in 2014, you've seen what's been called a scheme government. Like, it just schemes for the poor, like nonstop schemes, right? Welfare schemes, like a scheme to get a bank account and a scheme for the elderly and a, you know, scheme to put in more infrastructure in villages and a scheme for water and a scheme for sanitation. So it's a welfare scheme government. And I think, you know, sharp analyses, what they've shown is the scheme politics has been allowed to proceed apace alongside with oligarchical concentration, as I mentioned earlier, the 10% owning 77% of the country's wealth, right? And so that's a really interesting sort of welfarism or welfare performativity meets oligarchical consolidation, right? Meets traditionalism and nativism and ethno-nationalism and othering of the Muslim. And all of these kind of work to have shored up, I think in particular, the 2014, the 2019 elections. Now, what you saw happening in the 2024 elections is some losing of ground of Modi and some and surprising victories actually that happened. And that is, I think, where people are placing hope now, is that then you have the poor seeing through some of these scheme performativities, right? That will really take mass political education, mass reaching out, mass, you know, on the ground party work. Because this is the thing that's common in Brazil, the United States, and India, is the right is so well ensconced in the grassroots, right? You have your evangelical churches, you have, you know, by the way, Trump is now marketing a Bible. Like, you know, the infiltration of right-wing ideology into sort of the nitty-gritty and the small pores of sort of grassroots organizing in India. You have the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangha, which is the RSS, which is the far-right paramilitary flank of the BJP. And these guys, you know, in Nazi-style sort of training camps will go out. They'll set up like COVID vaccination camps, and they'll set up like, you know, all these types of like grassroots or oriented welfare services that are also then passing on the right-wing ideology, right, to people. And so the left is not like that. The left is not in every single social reproduction sphere. So that is another modality of consent creation, I think, that the left really needs to take stock of, you know, let's say through the victory of Zoran Mamdani, that really managed to reach every far corner of Queens, Bangladeshi speaking, Mandarin speaking, right? Area of New York City and borough that was much more grassroots based than what the Dems typically do. And they just sort of sit in their, you know, in their plush corners of the hill and don't necessarily connect in the same way to working class interests. And that definitely needs to change, I think, in all three countries. And you know, there are some obviously clear examples of this that I can get into later.
Yeah, great. I mean, yeah, it's troubling how, like, well, yeah, troubling how like the right all became kind of Gramscian slash Leninists at some point about 10, 12 years ago. And we're like, yeah, building these kind of, well, maybe longer than that in terms of the RSS, obviously. But like, Steve Bannon quoting Lenin and things like this, you see like this kind of real, like deliberate, like attempt to think about how you build a movement and that kind of grassroots work. It's, I'm relating to those like communities, organizations that exist already or indeed developing your own and making politics. It getting politics into people's day-to-day life, really, rather than it being something that happens on the television or something. I think that's, you know, really important. And obviously, yeah, the hope is that we can try and do that from the left, as Mamdani has perhaps started to show is possible, at least in New York. So Leonardo, again, I guess just to come to you then with that question, if you have anything to add in terms of like, yeah, this relationship between kind of authoritarian populism and sort of maintaining or new sort of forms of hegemony that are being developed in, particularly in kind of urban contexts.
I think that what we are looking at is, of course, that all this government, they have an authoritarian project. So, of course, the kind of hegemony they are building is less based on consent and more in coercion. Just to bring Brazil's example, Bolsonaro, during all his term, he kept around 30% of political support. But he almost was reelected. He lost by less than 2% of the total voters. So what is interesting to see is that he has a small base in terms of political support, but he needs to keep this base in permanent mobilization. So they are highly engaged in social networks, but they are also highly engaged in street protests and other forms of public demonstrations, and they can use this mobilization during the electoral process to enhance and to make their political support higher. And of course, they can use, when they were in the state, they could use some tools like reducing the gas price or reducing the energy price in the months before the elections, or given an extra money for some social programs and this kind of things that were very important for him to get this support in the last months before the election, that was almost enough to give him the re-election. And now that they are back in the opposition, probably in Brazilian case, Bolsonaro won't be able to run the next election, because he is facing lots of juridical process due to his coup d'etat attempt that he organized when he was still the president. The right wing is bringing back all the problems that we are facing now internationally in terms of the economic crisis, the cost of living crisis, and of course, bringing back the corruption discourse and the problems in terms of urban violence and etc. to try to build a discourse that will be able to face Lula in the next election, that's next year. And Lula, again, is losing lots of his support. So it's not easy for him to build a new hegemony in the left side. So I think we have an international crisis of neoliberalism right now. And independently of who is in the office, if it's the right or the left, what we're seeing now is that they are all having troubles to be reelected. The main problem probably is neoliberalism. Unless we develop new forms of social protection, new forms of social rights, especially for working poor people who live in peripheral neighborhoods and etc. So we won't be able to rebuild this hegemony in for the next few years. And finally, just to touch on a point that you brought, that's this relation between the state and the real estate market. When it comes to Brazil, all the urban expansion was were made through a peripherization of the city. So the city grew through its peripheries in precarious and in areas where there were no public or private services for the population. And what we see now, especially if we look to Rio de Janeiro, which is from where Bolsonaro is from, is new forms of appropriation of lands that are usually in environmental protection areas by criminal organizations or criminal and state forces organizations that we usually call it militias, that are formed by former or current police officers and fire workers and other state agents in partnership with criminal organization that are occupying illegally these areas, these environmental protection areas. And this is now also happening in some areas in the peripheries of São Paulo. Maybe we could see this thing, this new process of urban expansion through a Marxist lens, following David Harvey's idea of accumulation by spoliation, where this local groups, usually criminal and state slash criminal organizations, are appropriating public or environmental protection areas to sell illegal settlements for working poor populations. So this is how I see this connection between the state and the real estate and the urban expansion in Brazil right now.
Yeah, okay. Well, yeah, I mean, that's terrifying. Well, the question that's come up a lot, I think, when I've talked about this with others and you know, writing about it, this relation between the authoritarian and neoliberal particularly, is a question of like intensification rather than necessarily this like dramatic break. And, you know, possibly with opening up to a dramatic break as well, Melanie, you mentioned the term illiberal. Obviously, that's another term that people use to suggest that actually what we're perhaps seeing is a break from the very kind of institutions and established institutions of liberal democracy, whether that, you know, for better or worse, obviously, but, you know, that ranges from, you know, elections, but also things like judiciary or free press, all these kind of things, which, yeah, was, I'm not saying these things were perfect or even fully existed ever, but perhaps even an attack on those is like the reason why we're experiencing various sorts of economic and political crises, right? So, yeah, to think about this question, I guess what I'm trying to say is like, Are we seeing like this kind of intensification of kind of what was, you know, broadly the pattern of development in cities for the last 20 or 34 years in lots of places, which is basically try and remove regulations, try and displace people in order to build the next new bit of the city, the next new tower block, the next new sports stadium, the next new whatever it is, right? The next new highway or, you know, train line or whatever it is, you know. Big project, mega projects, or just sort of day-to-day kind of development of housing or the kind of infrastructure. Is that just intensifying? And is it getting to a point where it's different, you know, they've kind of given up on this idea of trying to do things through consent or consensus or democracy or any of these kind of, you know, even if they were just pretending in the past, like local states or governments, or at the same time, and that's just being supported by a more explicit policing, basically, or in the case that you've had that, you know, a kind of vigilantism, state-backed vigilantism. Is it just that, like, which was always there anyway, to some extent, right? But now we're just intensifying these things, right? So intensifying the drive forward for growth and development. And to do that, we need more violence, right? Like, we need that to ratchet those two things up together. The question, I guess, is there something new emerging, right? Is it going to be that the violence becomes more important than the development, right? Something like that. Is it gonna, you know, is there something new happening in that sense of, is there a new, you know, do we see signs of some sort of newer formation, I guess, or this new, a new kind of, even thinking of it in terms of hegemony, like a new coalition of people that's being led by this kind of politics? Or is it really just a doubling down and doubling down again and doubling down again of the same kind of things that we've seen in the last 10 or 20 years, both in terms of you know, policing and authoritarian politics, as well as a model of development, right? So maybe, again, Nate, I guess I'll go to you first.
I think Malini is actually the one to really properly answer this question. I really do feel like the neoliberal concept has often been stretched to its limits. And perhaps what we're really talking about here is the challenge of terminology and how far can we really continue to think with this neoliberal term. So is it perhaps that we're starting to see something else, and that captures the broader social, political, and economic divisions that we see in the world today? You also mentioned before the media landscape. How do we actually bring that into these conversations here, right? Especially as we sort of see that touching down of the infrastructures of our digital life. And it is sort of being used as yet another way to build up urban development schemes in various parts of the world related to data centers and this sort of infrastructure of the social life. It has really, really quite different social and spatial manifestations than many of us think about when we use that concept of neoliberalism and are often thinking that through in terms of the sort of the withdrawal of the welfare state. So I would say that welfare state is long gone. So I wonder instead what some of the reference are that might help us better think through the changing digital ecosystem that we find ourselves in and what those spatial expressions are and how they have those the social ramifications broadly.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, data centers is like a really interesting and really, like, I think development in the US in particular, but I think also we're starting to see the signs of this in the UK too. Like the governance probably is a better way is required to deliver them, like, you know, in ignorance of their ecological consequences and such, like.
Yes, and it also brings in a lot of questions about data sovereignty, political sovereignty, and questions that have a very there's a very different spatial expression of those sovereignty regimes, as John Agnew puts it. Yeah, I just don't think that the neoliberal concept really helps us think through some of those social and spatial reconfigurations.
Yeah, I know that makes sense. Yeah, Melanie, I guess we asked the same sort of question about intensification versus something new. Or...
Yeah, I totally agree with Natalie's point about neoliberalism being a very limited theoretical framework to really grasp at what's going on today. I think not least because if in many ways neoliberalism was a kind of state-enforced market deepening of a previous liberal project, right, which was sort of, you know, the free market and, you know, democracy and free trade, et cetera, privatization, we're seeing today really the collapse of the of whatever was it, the liberal order, you know, that obviously, as Natalie started off saying, you know, Black and brown and Indigenous people have always felt the illiberal dimensions of liberalism, but even for those people who did experience liberalism, right, in the many ways that sort of veil or the gloves have kind of come off. But at the same time, it is also a deepening of capital accumulation, right, through violent processes. And so to the extent that was also part of the neoliberal project, that absolutely is continuing. And I think that's the point you're making a special issue as well, right? Is that sort of extension of that sort of the violent processes through which capital is accumulated. So I guess to answer your question, are we seeing a redoubling of previous trends, or are we seeing something completely new? I think that we are seeing, as I mentioned, this sort of continuation of violent forms of capital expansion. We're seeing this sort of complete myth of liberalism sort of falling apart. And this is nowhere more obvious than in Gaza, right? If you take liberalism as an international project as well, a post-Cold War international project, you know, the liberal international order, it's completely in shambles. The nakedness of the sham of what that was, you know, has really kind of been laid bare in Gaza. And then I think what's also qualitatively different then about the current moment is, again,
you know, the nakedness through which racism is really at play right now. I mean, it's so, so in your face, right? And at least I would say under neoliberalism, there's a sort of pretense to the market being a force of inclusion, right? And that if you just work hard enough, you know, you might make it kind of thing, right? And so you had the liberalization in the 1990s of India's economy, and you had, you know, this sort of notion of, you know, bootstraps kind of work ethic. But I think now, you know, even that, I think that pretense has sort of fallen apart. I think that it's sort of racism that actually is the logic through which also capital is operating, right? And thus the concept of racial capitalism becomes ever more important. Because by using that analytical concept, right, carefully and in a kind of situated way, then neoliberalism becomes less the concept of traction, and this intersection of race and capitalism becomes the tractionable concept in my kind of reading of the current political economic moment, and this sort of the real bald-faced nature of racism right now, you know, in many different corners of the world.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the gloves are off kind of thing is definitely, you know, I think the thing we can see across all these different contexts, isn't it? Particularly obviously internationally in terms of Gaza and this has been discussed in the UK in terms of like the Iraq war in the UK. There was at least the end result was still obviously the same, but there was at least a pretense that there was some sort of process, right? That there was a vote, there was a vote in parliament, there was a process through the UN, which obviously was not great, but like there was some idea that there was some law that had to be followed in some way.
It's even the pretense of liberalism has seemed somehow been laid waste to, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Again, Leonardo, I guess the same sort of question, right, on intensification versus sort of, I guess, a new formation of audience.
Well, first, I agree with Natalie and Melanie about the need to better characterize what we are talking about when you say neoliberalism. I'd like to bring back Carlos Polanyi, the Great Transformation book, in which he sees the former liberalism project as a radical commodification of three elements, which he calls fictitious commodities, that are labor, nature, and money. And I think that neoliberalism tries to update this project, bringing together the one element in terms of subjectivity. That's the idea that Foucault explores and other authors more recently around the idea of the homo economics and etc. When we look for the current phase of capitalism that we are living through, I believe that there is, of course, an intensification of the process that started back in the 80s and 90s. And this intensification is part of the response to the 2008 economic crisis. But through this intensification, it is changing to something else, and which is the authoritarian process that we are seeing today. But it remains this project of radical commodification of labor, nature, and money, with the politics of reducing the protection of work, of reducing the protection to the environment, and all the political the austerity politics and etc. But what I think it's important also for us to understand is that from the left, from the progressive side, we need to rethink democracy, and especially liberal and representative democracy, because it was not giving the proper answers that people were expecting from it. Especially if we look for the Brazilian case, in which democracy arrived together with neoliberalism, and lots of social programs and social rights that were promised after the 1988 Constitution weren't able to be achieved because we were facing austerity policies and other forms of limitation for the state. We really need to think that democracy is not just about going to the elections and having free speech, free press, and independent political powers, but democracy is much more about being capable of providing services and providing rights for the population. And that is something that neoliberalism definitely cannot bring for the population.
Yeah, I get it. And I think that's interesting. I think the reason we still use the term neoliberal in our issue is, I think, because among the way we describes it, it's actually a good book by Alex Williams and Jeremy Gilbert, which talks about the winners of neoliberalism, right? The people that were in, the particularly the sections of capital that were empowered, but also the class, as we've talked about, you know, I mentioned petty bourgeoisie class before, particularly if you're in Britain, you can see this quite distinctly, Margaret Thatcher appealing to that kind of group of people. So, and the kind of entrepreneur, I guess that's who I'm talking about. So there's that kind of an empowerment of that kind of section of society, as well as big tech and fossil capital and such, and real estate, right? Really fundamentally as well, real estate is really important in its empowerment, I think, during this period of time. So I guess, yeah, part of the reason we still continue to use it, I agree with what you say, Melanie, that, you know, capitalism, racial capitalism, is the underlying and core of the analysis. I think that's true. I also think that the kind of neoliberal project, and maybe even the liberal project, is collapsing, right? And I don't know if there's any way back for it. I think that's also the case. But I guess, yeah, it's that kind of idea that, like, within these kind of new formations, which we can't quite, you know, people have, they've got all sorts of different names for illiberal, authoritarian, neoliberal, etc. This still seems to be like, we're still privatizing everything, right? We're still, yeah, there's still like rounds of re-regulation and deregulation, and these kind of things still to seem to be persisting as well. So I guess that's the kind of reason we kind of stuck with that term, but completely, as we write, like, you know, we're not saying that this is like, certainly not hegemonic anymore, and certainly perhaps is like on the way out, right? In totally in decline. So I don't see that to disagree more. Just I think that it was almost like that people in power, various ruling classes across the world, are struggling to kind of figure out how they move things forward beyond these more kind of coercive kind of measures, I guess. Obviously, we could talk about this stuff for a lot longer, but I just wanted to come to maybe a final question, maybe offer some sort of hope for the future as well, as is, you know, it's a nice thing to do, at least after talking about all of the sort of terrible things that are happening in the world. Yeah, so I guess one of the things that I've thought about, and again, maybe coming back to this idea of consent or not and coercion to some extent, is this authoritarian politics, the authoritarian populism particularly, is very vengeful. It's obviously violent, in its language. It leads to violence directly, like enacted. But it also seems to be turning onto more and more people. And more different groups of people, including some people who actually have a bit more power and wealth as well, at least in the sort of, you know, intermediary or middle kind of level of society. We talked a bit about what it is offering and what it's not, and it's kind of more coercive aspects. But like, I guess what I'm thinking is like, yeah, is this kind of like constant like anger and grievance, especially when it doesn't necessarily lead to something cohesive for the people that initially support it. Is that sort of sustainable, really? Or is there a kind of limit to that? I mean, it obviously has been sustained for a period of time in most of the country, you know, all the countries that we've talked about today. But, you know, the kind of constant like moral panics or demonizing of various different groups of people, can that keep going, or are that, does it in the sort of extension of these powers, at least compared to what they might have been maybe 10 or 15 years ago, is there of sort of, you know, the powers of state and police and stuff, and extending that to more and more people, the violence of those institutions to more and more people, is there like fractures and cracks within that kind of project that we're seeing, right? And that gives opportunities for a more progressive alternative. So yes, again, I'll come to Natalie first and go around.
I have to say I am very much a pessimist on this question. I don't know that I can have any happy words for the closing here. My real sense is that we do continue to see the fracturing of social networks, like actual human social networks, not mediated social networks. That trend seems to be continuing, and I would say is perhaps even getting more exaggerated in response to a lot of the violence and attacks that we've seen, at least within the US context where I'm speaking from. I have a hard time imagining a huge transformation in the near term. But I should also say that I work now primarily in the Arabian Peninsula, but before that, I worked primarily in the former Soviet countries. And if you look at the trajectory of Russia over the years, it's remarkable how many different forms of authoritarian political configurations there are. So sometimes there's an easing, sometimes there's a hardening, sometimes ordinary people can kind of get by and feel okay about life. But we still don't see any sort of revolutionary toppling of an authoritarian system. And I think many people in Russia today are feeling even more, if they have any liberal inclinations, they are feeling more pessimistic about that future for Russia. So looking at that and feeling a lot of the similar dynamics in the United States context today, it feels a bit to me like the years, the disintegration of the Soviet Union. That's what a lot of Americans are sort of experiencing at the moment, the disintegration of the social fabric. It's not as dramatic and over the night as the collapse of the Soviet Union, but I really do feel that people are having the same reactions to that. I can't say that I feel very positive about this. But that said, there's still a lot of continued investment in the idea that the Silicon Valley people are going to come up with the next brilliant solution. So maybe the Mark Zuckerbergs and Elon Musks of the world will drop their chainsaws and get to building positive futures for us. I also have to say I'm very pessimistic about that outcome. But many people in the United States do still believe in some kind of silver bullet. And they really do hold on to hope that there will just be some easy fix. But alas, I'm not a believer in silver bullets.
Kind of, yeah, having that, maybe that's even more terrifying. And yeah, the Waymos are coming to save us, maybe. Yeah, sorry, Melody, over to you.
Well, I think that the kinds of upsurge that we've seen in the United States and Europe and globally over the last 18 months around Palestine has really kind of shown that there's a tremendous ability for people to self-educate and seek the truth. And for me, I think the starting point of any sort of liberatory future is that kind of, you know, that sort of self-education, political education, the unlearning that's happened, you know, in various spaces in the United States, Zionist spaces, where people are now, you know, seeing the violence of Israel and kind of becoming more anti-Zionist. So I think there is this sort of awareness and even terminology that's banned, like settler colonialism, right? The young people are using those terms. There's a way in which the more the state gets repressive, the more that I think young people have also been pushing back. And you'll see that student leaders in the United States, especially Palestinian and leaders, Palestinian allies, have been very brave. And so that's one area and I think, you know, I do believe that it's kind of a window into so many other types of issues. I mean, you mentioned in your special issue, you know, introduction that even Trump's awfully garish real estate video of Gaza is like, you know, part of what's going on. And so Gaza becomes this, and Palestine becomes this like window into so many other processes of oligarchy and right-wing authoritarianism and repression. And the fact that people are making those connections, like even with climate, you know, the fact that the bombardment of Gaza and the kind of military warfare is such a, you know, climate destroying apparatus. So that connection and that intersectionality, I think that young people have been drawing in my classroom, you know, on the streets, in activist forums that I've been attending, has been very helpful to me. It's like they're seeing beyond their horizons. And I think part of it is also that jolting that has happened where it's like, oh, the United States is not anything that we kind of thought it was, you know, and that's kind of almost been a sort of healthy jolting from the complacency. I don't know how long it will last, of course, but I do think that people have been shaken out of their complacency. And then I think coming to, you know, Global South and movements here, for me, I've been really interested and invested in kind of documenting and researching what I've called like sort of multi-pronged resistance, which is resistance that kind of that adopts different avenues, right? So on the one hand, you have lawyering, social movement lawyering, that fights evictions and labor abuses, right? And that's very much based on the kind of legal strategy. But then you also have the protests on the streets, the strikes, the sit-ins, and you also have the sort of re-narrativization and the kind of, you know, the discursive shift. So that multidimensional approach to activism that, you know, sometimes even single organizations or coalitions undertake, I think that coalition building and that multi-pronged activism is something that I've definitely tried to document in my work in contemporary India.
Yeah, yeah. And I think you're right. And I do sort of see something in the resistance to Palestine in terms of resistance to the genocide of Palestine in UK too, is that like the younger people particularly, but I think just people in general, particularly younger people. And by younger people, I'm talking about people under 35. I don't mean like, you know, 15-year-olds, but like, yeah, becoming more like, I'm not going to say anti-imperialist, that's probably too strong, but like much more critical, I think, of the sort of role of like Britain and indeed the US internationally, right? And in a way that I don't think would have been the case 30 or 40 years ago. Like, I think there was a more of, I think you're seeing a sort of generational break in terms of how people think of the role of a nation like Britain, obviously is an imperial nation historically, as well as obviously the US is the kind of dominant imperial power today. Yeah. Like,
can I just
that kind of challenge?
Interject here quickly to say that I appreciate the sentiment that both of you are reflecting about our students, but I think we cannot forget that our students are still a very privileged minority. And that is something that I think especially American academics lose sight of. I'm from Arizona. I am not from an elite background. I see that there are very many more young people who are MAGA supporters, who are absolutely not buying into the sorts of things that we are happy to celebrate in the academic spaces. So I agree with you. I think there's hope to be seen in what some people of the young generation are thinking about and talking about and recognizing in the violence and the global imperial forces today. But I would not say that they're a dominant grouping. It's just that we as academics tend to have a privileged view on what those groups are saying, but I don't think that they're dominant narratives in the US and in many other places, including Germany, where I have also taught.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I would, I guess what I was referring to, like, I wasn't referring to university students, I actually meant like younger people across the board in general, like within, say, Manchester or something like that, where it is. So I do also take your point that, like, both on, like, yeah, the extent to which, I guess, yeah, I this is just the UK, so I'm not speaking about America in this way, in this context. I guess the right are really struggling to win young people in the UK. They're really struggling. Like, they're trying to, they're coming up with all sorts of like schemes, they're putting loads of money into it, but they're still not able to capture younger people in the way that they had in the past. They were able to. Margaret Thatcher had loads of young people vote for her. So did like the National Front in the 70s, the far right party, lots of young people signing up for them, like in a period of economic, you know, crisis and stuff. So I think that they're struggling in the UK, certainly. And I appreciate it's very different in the US. They are struggling to cohere that kind of base, and partly Palestine, I think, plays into that as well as other things as well. There's other reasons for that, but I think there is a struggle to cohere it. But I do obviously completely take your point. Obviously, yeah, it's easy to look at to think they just university students resistance, and but yeah, I do think there is a struggle to quite fully cohere the right in that way. But I think that's I guess what probably a better way of saying it is that I think it's actually open. I think it's open, particularly for like. There's an open kind of battle for that kind of, say, millennial, younger millennial to younger people kind of generation, I think, where they've kind of, you know, there was left movements that they've supported, but then they could swing the other way as well. And I think that how that kind of group of people is going to kind of fall in the next 5 to 10 years and maybe kind of continue in their politics might be a huge deciding kind of point, I guess. Again, that's certainly what's what I think of from the UK point. Anyway, Leonardo, sorry.
Can I jump in that point? Because I think that I am also living in a very pessimistic moment. I think that we are living in that moment, just to quote Gramsci again, where the old is dead, but the new wasn't able to be born yet. Looking again for the Brazilian case, one thing that's very interesting that Brazil kind of repeated the United States with 2 years later. So when Trump was elected, 2 years later, Bolsonaro was elected, though we had the Trump lost the elections and Bolsonaro lost the elections. We had the January 6th with the invasion of the Capitol. And we had here in Brazil 2 years later, the invasion of the Congress on January 8th. And now Trump was reelected. And next year we have elections in Brazil. As I said, Bolsonaro probably won't be able to be the candidate, but maybe someone from his family, his sons, his wife, or some of a right-wing political supporter who are already promising and demanding for anyone that they must give some form of amnesty to Bolsonaro and everyone who was involved in the attempt at the coup d'etat that he attempted when he was still the president. We're living in a similar moment here in Brazil that the United States had 2 years ago with Lula, with 8 years old, needing to try re-election. And even if he is re-elected, he will probably won't be able to have a majority in the Congress. And 4 years after, there is no one that we can see that's a new leadership to take this place as the leader of the progressive and the left-wing parties. So in the long run, even though we see that, well, maybe some youngers are supporting progressive politics and are looking in a different way for some of these issues that we are talking about here, I don't know if we will be able to bring this together in a political program and have a new leadership who will be able to make this identification with these progressive agendas. I believe that we are looking for some, the next few years will be very challenging. And as I said, and in this, I agree with Natalie, we are living in a moment where pessimism is more prudent to be than be optimistic right now, you know?
Yeah. Okay, well, maybe I'll just try and bring it together before we finish in a both optimistic and pessimistic connection, which I think is like, I mean, I don't really disagree with anything that's been said in terms of there's no immediate cause to think that like these kind of particular political leaders are gonna, or indeed, you know, their successor, right? It might be the individual might lose, but then, yeah, as you say, maybe that direct relative will come and take over their role. And, you know, obviously the same is possible with Trump and indeed perhaps even with Modi at some point. What I can see is perhaps the fact that I think with each of these formations, and I think also same in the UK, but maybe we saw this a bit with the Conservatives in the UK, though I appreciate it weren't quite as, you know, there's obviously differences between the different places, but I still think this, they don't fully have an answer to the actual crises, which often get them elected, right? Like they don't really have an answer to the problems of, in some cases, economic stagnation, and in some cases, in terms of like the ecological crisis, they seem to have absolutely no answer to, right? Like how that's, and that the manifestations of that are only going to get more real and more dangerous. So that's pessimistic because I don't think things are immediately going to get better. But I feel like the fact that that inability to address those like material problems, I feel like they can't keep doing that. I feel like eventually that like, or at least in their failure to address them, opportunities arise, right? And that's not something we should be like excited about, but it probably is the reality, right? That if they can't quite get a grip on, or don't seem even interested, right, in getting to grip in some of these like serious problems that are affecting that even their own supporters' lives, right? Particularly things of like housing and yeah, ecological, you know, global warming, things like this. But I don't know if that's possible, both pessimistic and optimistic, I guess, in that maybe within that something else can be figured out. But yeah, we shouldn't necessarily just be optimistic for the sake of it, right? I mean, as we've discussed today, right, this is a dangerous time for many people across the world, and you know, even resisting it is difficult, but you know, people try. Yeah, okay, so I just want to finish there. I want to say thank you to all three of you for taking the time to participate in this. Obviously within the kind of notes of the show, we'll have links to each of the authors' like work, so you can kind of read in more detail about the stuff that we've talked about. And there are two more episodes coming up where we're focusing on more authoritarian practices and then actually tackling this question of liberalism as well as the kind of final question. So yeah, thanks to everyone for participating, thanks to everyone for listening, and yeah, please do tune in for the next two episodes.
Thanks to you for listening.
For more information, visit our website urbanpolitical.podigee.io.